May 25th, 2003, Luanda, Angola. 50-year-old Ben Charles Padilla, an American citizen overseeing a rebuilding project on a Boeing 727 at Quadro de Fevereiro International Airport, is reportedly seen boarding the plane alongside a Congolese mechanic named John Michael Mutantu. Shortly thereafter, the aircraft takes off without clearance and disappears. Since neither Padilla or Mutantu seem to have the necessary training required to fly a 727, there is speculation they may have been hijacked or that another person was behind the controls, but no trace of the two men or the missing aircraft is ever found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and today we're going to be exploring a truly unique mystery involving a missing plane and two men. The 2003 disappearances of Ben Charles Padilla and John Michael Mutantu. I once featured this story in an article I co-wrote at crack.com several years ago, and it's most definitely the first time our podcast has ever covered an unsolved cold case from the African country of Angola. But the story wound up receiving quite a bit of attention from the media because Ben Charles Padilla was an American citizen, and given that this was less than 2 years removed from 9/11, there was genuine fear that the missing aircraft might be used for some sort of terrorist attack. The reason Padilla became involved in this whole thing was because he was offered a contract job to oversee the rebuilding of a Boeing 727 at an airport in the Angolan capital of Luanda. But one day before the plane was scheduled to be flown elsewhere, it suddenly took off from the airport without permission, and Padilla and a mechanic on his crew named John Michael Mutantu were both believed to be on board. Under normal circumstances, there's an obvious explanation for mysteries involving missing aircraft, as you would assume it simply crashed into a body of water and was never recovered. However, this particular case is different, because even though Padilla was a private pilot with experience flying smaller planes, he had never been behind the controls of a 727 before, and it seems unlikely that he and Mutantu would have been capable of piloting such a large aircraft on their own. So there are a ton of unanswered questions about whether there was anyone else on board when the 727 took off, why it took off to begin with, and what ultimately happened to the plane and the two missing men. While Padilla's family have done everything they can to keep his story in the spotlight, there is virtually no information available about Mutantu's background, and as far as I can tell, he does not even have any existing photographs. But they are both technically missing persons who are at the center of a very unusual mystery, so we'll be exploring all the different theories on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. Also, I just wanted to mention that I elected to release an episode about this case this week because it was once covered on the Generation Y podcast way back in 2015, which is an appropriate segue to announce that I've recently recorded a special episode about another case alongside Aaron from Generation Y. It's going to be dropping into our feed later this week, but I'll share more details about it near the end of this episode. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the disappearances of Ben Charles Padilla and John Michael Mutantu. Thank you. Our story begins in 2003 in the Republic of Angola, a country located on the west coast of southern Africa. One of our central figures is 50-year-old Ben Charles Padilla Jr., who originally hails from Pensacola, Florida. Padilla has been living there with his spouse of 15 years and has two children, and he spent most of his life doing freelance work as a private pilot, aircraft mechanic, and a certified flight engineer. He has a reputation for solving difficult problems in the world of aviation, and has taken jobs in such countries as Paraguay, Nigeria, and Mozambique. Since the September 11 attacks had caused a slowdown in civil aviation work, Padilla was anxious to take any work he could find, so in March of this year, he accepted a job which would involve traveling to the Angolan capital of Luanda. Padilla was hired by Aerospace Sales and Leasing Incorporated, a Miami-based company owned by a man named Maury Joseph, whom Padilla has worked with on two previous jobs. The project will involve Padilla supervising a team of mechanics to perform repair work on a Boeing 727 airplane, which is currently being housed in a hangar at Cuatro de Fevereiro International Airport. The 727 was built in 1975 as part of their 200 series and had been used as a passenger jet at American Airlines for 25 years before it was acquired by Aerospace Sales and Leasing. In 2002, Maury Joseph made a deal to lease out the 727 to a South African businessman named Keith Irwin for $1 million. Irwin had signed a contract to use the plane to transport fuel to remote diamond mining outposts in Angola, so the aircraft had most of its passenger seats removed from the cabin, and it was outfitted with 10 500-gallon drums containing diesel fuel. Irwin arranged for the 727 to be flown to Cuatro de Fevereiro Airport, but while Joseph received a $125,000 down payment, Irwin reneged on his original promise to pay the rest of the $1 million within 30 days, so the entire deal fell through. For this reason, the 727 will remain grounded at the airport for 14 months, accumulating a number of unpaid fees, so Padilla was given the assignment of restoring the plane into flyable condition. The team of Angolan mechanics whom Padilla supervised were hired from a repair station at the Luanda-based airline Air Gemini, and he also had the responsibility of hiring a pilot and co-pilot from them. After the repair work is completed, they will be tasked with flying the 727 to Johannesburg, South Africa, where Joseph has made a deal to sell the plane's engines to another buyer, and Padilla will be the flight engineer when this trip takes place. However, before they can take off, Aerospace Sales and Leasing is responsible for dealing with the 727's unpaid fees at the airport, so in early May, Joseph traveled to Luanda to give $43,000 to Padilla. After Padilla used the money to pay the fees, he faxed the receipt to Joseph. On May the 25th, the repair work was pretty much completed, so Padilla made arrangements with Air Gemini to take the 727 out of the company hangar onto the main runway. Since the plane's flight to Johannesburg was scheduled for the following day, Padilla wanted to run the three engines up to full power in order to perform a systems check. Well, at some point during the early evening hours, Padilla was reportedly seen boarding the 727 alongside one of his crew members, John Mikel Mutantu. Mutantu was a mechanic from the Republic of Congo and had been hired by Padilla to be his helper. At around 6 p.m., everyone at the airport was surprised to see the 727 taxiing down the runway, but no one had attempted to communicate with the radio control tower to request clearance to take off, and no flight plan was ever submitted. When the tower officers attempted to make contact with the plane's radio, there was no response. According to those who saw it, the 727 appeared to be maneuvering erratically as it spun around and traveled down the runway, and its lights were not turned on. After the plane took off, it appeared to be heading southwest towards the Atlantic Ocean and flying low, possibly to avoid radar. Since the aircraft's transponder had been switched off, it was impossible to track with radar, and its emergency locator beacon was believed to be inoperable at that time. As a result, this would be the last time anyone ever saw the 727, as well as Ben Charles Padilla and John Mikel Mutantu. The air traffic controllers did not immediately report this incident to Angolan authorities, and it was only after Maury Joseph learned his plane had gone missing the following day that he decided to notify the American authorities about what was going on. Naturally, Given that this took place only 20 months after the events of 9/11, there was genuine concern that the plane had been stolen for the purposes of orchestrating a terrorist attack, so the FBI, the CIA, and the NSA became involved in the investigation. The 727 was 153 feet long and weighed 191,000 pounds, and at the time it took off, it was unpainted in silver and had red, white, and blue stripes. The tail number was N844AA, while the plane's serial number was 20985. The investigating agencies put out a worldwide alert and used spy satellites to take pictures of remote airstrips throughout Africa to see if the plane might have landed somewhere. The U.S. would be assisted in their search effort by intelligence services from the United Kingdom, France, Russia, and several African nations. On the day the aircraft went missing, someone reportedly walked into a fuel shack in Luanda and paid $93,000 in cash, but this person's identity has never been established. At the time it took off, the plane was believed to have over 8,000 gallons of fuel in its tanks, which would have allowed it to travel approximately 2,400 kilometers, and it was also carrying about 5,000 gallons of additional fuel inside the 10 drums it had on board. If the 727 had traveled northeast of Angola, it would have passed through an area south of the Sahara Desert, which is often referred to by pilots as the Gauntlet, as it is a vast, virtually uncontrolled airspace which has little radar or air traffic control, making it easier to fly and land an aircraft undetected. There would be one report that the 727 had made radio contact to ask for permission to land in the Republic of Seychelles, an island nation in the Indian Ocean, located over 4,600 kilometers east of Luanda. However, officials from Seychelles denied ever having seen or heard from the plane, and it would have needed to stop and refuel on the African mainland at some point in order to make the full trip. On June the 28th, a Canadian pilot reported having seen the 727 in Conakry, the capital city of the Republic of Guinea, located over 3,600 kilometers northwest of Luanda. Even though the aircraft had been freshly painted, and a new registration number, 3XGOM, had been sprayed over the aluminum, the pilot said that the last two letters of the missing 727's tail number were still visible. The plane had been re-registered in Guinea, and was being flown by a Lebanese-owned company named Union de Transport Africains to transport goods between Beirut and Conakry. Believe it or not, 6 months later, on Christmas Day, a Guinea-registered Boeing 727, owned by Union de Transports Africains, crashed while taking off on a flight to Lebanon from the country of Benin as it clipped a building at the end of the runway and plunged into the Atlantic Ocean, killing 130 of the 161 people on board. Investigators looked into the possibility that this might have been the same missing 727, but that turned out not to be the case, and transport officials from Guinea and the U.S. Department of State would later confirm that the 727 seen in Conakry on June the 28th was not the same aircraft which took off in Luanda. Following his disappearance, Padilla's siblings made appearances on a number of prominent TV shows, including Good Morning America and CNN Morning News, in order to spread awareness about his story. They claimed that the last contact they made with Padilla was after his mother suffered a heart attack on Mother's Day, 2 weeks before he went missing. When one of Padilla's siblings emailed him with the news, he replied and said he would contact their mother as soon as he could, but no one from the family ever heard from him again. While there was suspicion that Padilla could have stolen the 727 himself, his family did not believe this, and he had no documented history of criminal behavior. Of course, it was also theorized that the 727 could have been hijacked and stolen by an unknown third party. According to Padilla's brother, he once had a conversation about 9/11, where he stated that if he was ever behind the controls of a plane that was hijacked, he would intentionally crash it rather than be forced to fly somewhere against his will. Indeed, there was also skepticism about whether Padilla would have even been capable of stealing the aircraft, as he only had a private pilot's license to fly smaller planes, and he was not certified by the U.S. Federal Aviation Authority to fly a 727. Since Jean-Michel Mutantu was not a pilot, it was unknown whether or not he would have had any capability to fly the aircraft, and a 727 usually requires at least 3 trained crew members to operate it. American authorities also theorized that the plane was made to disappear intentionally as part of some sort of financial scam or business dispute, but no evidence could be found to support this. In September of 2010, the story would be featured in an extensive article in Air and Space magazine written by Tim Wright. According to Padilla's sister, Benita, the FBI had decided to close the investigation into his disappearance in 2005 without informing them. They would not give any reason for this, and Benita claimed that she was trying to persuade them to reopen the investigation because she had, quote-unquote, new information. Padilla's family believes that the FBI knows more about what happened than they are letting on, but all of the investigating agencies declined to provide comment for the article, citing national security concerns. So after 2 decades, Ben Charles Padilla, John Miquel Matantu, and the missing Boeing 727 have still never been found. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So like I mentioned in the intro, this is definitely one of the more unique aviation mysteries I've ever seen, and there is good reason to believe there might be a lot more to this story than a plane simply crashing into a body of water and disappearing forever. I first learned about this case several years ago, and even featured it in an article I co-wrote about baffling disappearances at crack.com. But it should be mentioned that just because the missing 727 has never been found, does not necessarily mean it did not crash. As I'm sure you're well aware, the biggest aviation mystery of the modern era is the disappearance of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, a Boeing 777 jet, which vanished during a flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing with 227 passengers and 12 crew on board on March 8, 2014. While it's been theorized that the plane went down somewhere in the Indian Ocean, the most expensive search effort in the history of aviation has failed to pinpoint an official crash site or turn up any wreckage of the missing aircraft, as its transponder stopped functioning at some point during the flight. I know there was an extensive search effort to find this missing aircraft, but if Flight 370 could remain undiscovered all this time, then it's not impossible that the 727 might also be at the bottom of the ocean somewhere. But even if the aircraft really did crash, there are still a lot of unanswered questions about what happened, because unlike Flight 370, this was not a routine commercial flight. All we know is that the 727 suddenly took off without authorization, and apparently had two men on board, Ben Charles Padilla and John Miquel Matantu, but as far as anyone can tell, neither of them would have had the necessary qualifications to fly an aircraft that size on their own unless they had assistance. So there are endless possibilities here. Did Padilla and Matantu make an attempt to steal the plane, but wound up crashing because of their inexperience? Was the 727 made to disappear intentionally, as part of some elaborate fraud or insurance scheme? Was the plane hijacked by an unknown party, and Padilla and Matantu were completely innocent victims who were taken hostage? Well, it would be incredibly difficult, if not outright impossible, to steal a 150-foot jet in North America and land it without anyone noticing. This particular section of Africa is pretty much considered to be the Wild West when it comes to regulating air traffic, so maybe it really did slip under the radar, literally. But if the plane did not actually crash, how do you make an entire 727 just disappear? Well, one thing I am fairly certain of is that this plane was not stolen for the purposes of a terrorist attack. But given how this took place less than 2 years after 9/11, I can definitely understand how there would have been a genuine fear about this, and why so many American intelligence agencies became involved in the investigation. What was especially terrifying is that the aircraft had 10 additional 500-gallon drums of diesel fuel on board, which would have caused additional destruction if someone intentionally crashed the plane as part of a suicide mission. Of course, the 727 did not have enough fuel in its tank to travel all the way across the Atlantic to North America, but the possibility was explored that the plane might be used to target one of the American embassies in Africa. But since nothing like this ever came to fruition, it seems more likely that the aircraft might have been stolen for financial gain. For reasons unknown, the FBI closed their investigation in 2005, And since they've never told anyone, not even Padilla's family, why they did this, it's easy to assume they have key information which they've never released publicly. I think that figuring out what actually happened at the 727 might depend a lot on what you believe about the character of Ben Charles Padilla. Was he the type of person that would willingly become involved in the theft of an aircraft? Well, Padilla's siblings have always said nothing but glowing things about him to the media, maintaining that they were a tight-knit family and that he never would have become embroiled in criminal activity and disappeared voluntarily without contacting them, particularly while their mother was recovering from a bad heart attack. But oddly enough, we really don't know all that much about Padilla's relationship with his spouse and his children, and we don't even know their names. All that's been confirmed publicly is that the couple were together for 15 years and that Padilla had two children. We also know that even though the couple never officially married, Padilla gave his spouse power of attorney and made her executor of his estate, leaving her almost everything in his will. As far as I can tell, Padilla's spouse and children have never given any interviews to the media and did not provide any comment for Tim Wright's extensive article in Air and Space magazine. But you have to wonder if they believe that Padilla might be the type of person who would have just abandoned them and broke off all contact. Another person who has spoken glowingly of Padilla is Maury Joseph, the head of Aerospace Sales and Leasing, who hired him to restore the 727 in Luanda. Padilla had worked two previous jobs for Joseph, who considered him to be a model employee that he greatly trusted, and Joseph has gone on record stating that he does not believe Padilla stole his aircraft. On the other hand, another person interviewed for that Air and Space magazine article who had the opposite impression of Padilla was Jeff Swain. Sometime during the 1990s, Swain hired Padilla to do work for an airline he was operating in Indonesia, but he said that Padilla was more focused on chasing women than his job. When Swain finally fired Padilla, he remained at the hotel he was staying at for the next 2 months, racking up a $10,000 bill, which he said the airline would pay, before he was finally deported. Swain also said that Padilla had a tendency to share stories which seemed completely untrue, as he apparently liked to show off photographs of women and claim they were his wives in countries like Mozambique, Tanzania, and Indonesia. The idea of Padilla secretly having families in other countries besides his family in Florida is an intriguing possibility which might have given him a potential motive to disappear voluntarily, but this was never conclusively proven. In an ironic turn of events, Maury Joseph had actually set up Swain as his next interested buyer because even though Swain thought the 727 was a piece of junk, he was interested in purchasing its engines. In fact, Joseph and Swain had both been waiting for the plane to land in Johannesburg the day after it went missing. Given his own personal experience with Padilla, I get the impression that Swain would not have been the least bit surprised if he found out that Padilla had arranged to steal the aircraft. But before I talk more about this theory, I have to provide some more backstory about how the 727 wound up stranded at Cuatro de Fevereiro International Airport. It's covered in great detail in the aforementioned Air and Space magazine article, and it sounds like the purchasing and leasing of used aircraft is a pretty shady business in Africa. I mentioned earlier that a South African businessman named Keith Irwin had originally leased the 727 from Maury Joseph for the purposes of transporting fuel to the diamond mines in Angola. Irwin hired an American crew and brought them all over to Luanda to perform the job, but they were forced to live in squalid conditions at an apartment without electricity or drinkable water, and were ordered to surrender their passports upon arrival. The crew was often under the escort of an armed guard carrying an AK-47, and they became so paranoid that things were going to go wrong that they briefly considered the possibility of stealing the 727 to escape the country and fly back to the United States on their own. While they did eventually get their passports back, two of the crew members were so anxious to leave that they flew home on commercial flights without completing the job or getting paid. The remaining crew did perform some flights where they transported fuel to the diamond mines on the 727, but they were forced to land on dangerous airstrips with runways which were not paved. At one point, they arrived at one of these airstrips just in time to see a 727 from a different company skid off the runway and crash, killing some local residents. This was pretty much the crew's breaking point, so after they finally received their first payment, they decided to skip the country and fly home. Irwin was planning to hire a local crew to keep delivering fuel, but the problem is that a civil war which had been taking place in Angola at that time was finally coming to an end. One of the reasons there was a market for using planes to transport fuel to these diamond mine outposts was because the roads there were far too unsafe. But the end of the Civil War meant that these deliveries can now be made with trucks. So Irwin now had a lot more competition, and aside from the $125,000 down payment he sent to Joseph, he did not have the money to pay the full $1 million he had promised for leasing the 727. At one point, Irwin believed he was being followed by a shady figure, and his breaking point was when he caught someone attempting to enter his hotel room with a keycard. When Irwin learned that this person had bribed a night clerk to give him the keycard, he finally skipped the country, and the 727 was left stranded at Cuatro de Fevereiro International Airport. So in essence, Ben Charles Padilla was hired by Maury Joseph to clean up a huge mess and ensure that his aircraft would be returned to him. Well, given what a train wreck this entire business deal was, it probably shouldn't surprise you to learn that Joseph also did not have the most stellar reputation. In 1997, while CEO of another cargo airline called Florida West Airlines, the Securities and Exchange Commission charged Joseph with falsifying financial statements and defrauding investors by exaggerating the company's profits. As a result, Joseph received a $50,000 fine and was barred from acting as an officer in a publicly traded company, though this obviously didn't stop him from starting aerospace sales and leasing. Given Joseph's background, you can understand why there was suspicion that the disappearance of the 727 might have been some sort of insurance scam, especially since he did not get paid all the money he was owed when he leased the aircraft to Keith Irwin. But the problem is that the plane was never actually found, so it doesn't look like Joseph collected any money or benefited at all from its disappearance. When contacted by the FBI to be questioned about his possible complicity in what happened, Joseph volunteered to take a lie detector test, though it's unclear if he actually did so. It would be one thing if the company had been planning to fly the 727 back to the US and keeping it around was a big financial loss to them, but Joseph had already made arrangements with Jeff Swain to purchase the aircraft's engines, so it seems odd that he would intentionally arrange for the plane to disappear when he was set to make some money off of it. Swain also came to Joseph's defense because the two men had been waiting together at the airport in Johannesburg when Joseph received a phone call about the 727 taking off without authorization. On the basis of his reaction, Swain believed that Joseph looked genuinely shocked and confused when he learned about what happened, and he seemed to be completely in the dark about the whole situation. Joseph also showed no hesitation about immediately contacting the American Embassy and the authorities to report the aircraft missing. One reason I am inclined to believe that Joseph is completely innocent in this mess because of the unpaid fees which had accrued from the 727 being stranded at the airport for over a year. Remember, only weeks before the plane vanished, Joseph gave Padilla $43,000 to pay off these fees, but I'm not sure why Joseph would be willing to part with all that money if he was just planning to have Padilla steal the 727 and make it disappear, as it doesn't sound like this airport had many security measures to prevent an unauthorized flight. In fact, since the air traffic controllers never bothered to inform the authorities about what was happening after the plane originally took off, it's been theorized that someone may have bribed them to look the other way, which might be a cheaper alternative to paying the fees. It's also worth noting that since Padilla apparently faxed Joseph a receipt, we know that the fees were paid off, so if he was planning to commit theft, you have to wonder why Padilla wouldn't just keep the $43,000 for himself. So while there have been differing accounts from different people about Padilla's character, one of the most frustrating elements of this entire case is that there's virtually no information about the man who disappeared alongside him, John Miquel Mutantu. Since he's also technically a missing person, I really don't want him to be forgotten in this whole story, but other than the fact that he's Congolese and worked as Padilla's helper on his crew of mechanics, that's all there really is to say about him. So I have no idea if he was the type of person who would willingly participate in a theft or hijacking. Details about the last confirmed eyewitness sightings of both these men are pretty sketchy, as all we know is that Padilla asked for the 727 to be moved out of its hangar onto the runway to test the engines. This definitely makes sense, since they were planning to fly to Johannesburg the following day, which would have been the first time that plane took off into the air in over a year. If Padilla arranged for the aircraft to be stolen, then you definitely understand using this engine test as a convenient reason to take it out onto the runway. I've already established that even though Padilla was an experienced pilot of smaller planes, he did not have the necessary qualifications to fly a 727. I mean, it's unclear to me if he had even flown a simulation for one before. He was planning to be the flight engineer on the Johannesburg flight, and he had already hired a pilot and co-pilot from Air Gemini to take the controls, but we know that those two men were not on the plane when it took off on the evening of May the 25th. The phone call Joseph received the following morning to inform him about the 727's disappearance was actually from Air Gemini, who were wanting to know why the plane left without their two pilots. This makes you wonder why Padilla would have even gone to the trouble of hiring these guys in the first place if he was planning to steal the plane. So was anyone else besides Padilla and Matantu on board when the aircraft took off? Well, there were definitely signs that something was amiss, because the plane's lights were never turned on, and it was described as swerving erratically while taxiing down the runway. Given Padilla's inexperience with flying a 727, this could be seen as a sign that he was having issues handling the plane, which would lend credence to the idea that it crashed sometime after takeoff. Or it's possible that the aircraft was swerving because someone was fighting over the controls. If this had taken place at an American airport, I'd say the odds of being able to board a 727 and hijack it like this would pretty much be non-existent, but I'm not sure security at Cuatro de Fevereiro International Airport would have been all that tight. The issue is that we don't know anything about the other mechanics on Padilla's crew besides Matantu, and whether they would have had the means, opportunity, and motive to steal the plane. Hell, for all we know, maybe Matantu himself orchestrated the theft, and Padilla was an innocent victim. The big issue is that the details about all these key players' movements when this happened are so murky, as they basically amount to, plane was moved from the hangar onto the runway at one moment, and was seen taking off the next. Of course, another possibility is that the plane itself was not the motive for the theft, but rather the 10 500-gallon tanks of diesel fuel it had on board. One of the biggest wildcards in this case is the fact that someone was apparently seen paying $93,000 in cash at a fuel shack on the day the plane disappeared, but it's never been established if this person was Padilla or someone else. For all we know, this could have been a legitimate transaction to gas up the 727's tanks and also pay for the fuel inside the drums, but the money could have also been a bribe or something more nefarious. It's been reported that the plane had enough fuel in its tanks to fly up to 2,400 kilometers, but if they wanted to travel farther, they could have possibly landed somewhere and used the fuel inside the drums to fill up the tanks again. In the months following the plane's disappearance, I know that Padilla's family were publicly expressing their hope that he had been taken against his will when the plane was stolen and was being held captive somewhere. But as time went on, they acknowledged it was less and less likely that anyone was keeping him alive for so long. I can definitely understand that being the best case scenario for them, because the alternatives would have been Padilla being murdered, or willingly participating in a criminal act in which he decided to disappear and cut off all contact from his loved ones. Or alternatively, he made an attempt to steal the plane himself, but because of his inexperience flying a 727, he wound up crashing into the ocean, which would be a pretty senseless death. Regardless of whether Padilla, Matantu, or both of them were complicit in the theft, I'm still inclined to believe that they could not have taken the plane into the air by themselves, so there had to be at least one other person on board at that time. But whether they were all working together, or if Padilla and Matantu were kidnapped against their will, is still unclear. If the 727 did not crash and actually landed somewhere, it's possible that whoever was responsible might have decided to abandon their original plan and destroy the plane a short time later. Under normal circumstances, this story might not have garnered much attention, because like I mentioned earlier, this particular section of Africa is considered to be the Wild West when it comes to dealings involving aircraft. But because the missing plane belonged to an American businessman and an American citizen went missing, this incident wound up jump-starting a large-scale investigation involving the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, and several countries, so it would not have been beneficial for anyone to have a stolen 727 in their possession at that time. Remember, the plane's description, tail number, and serial number were circulated everywhere, and most of its passenger seats have been removed and replaced with drums of fuel, so this is definitely an aircraft which would have stood out. Then again, destroying a plane that large and selling its parts for scrap is a pretty big job, so it would not have been easy for anyone to cover their tracks. Whatever the case, I would wager that the 727 is not sitting in some hangar after all these years, so it was likely destroyed at some point, or it's at the bottom of the ocean somewhere. As far as Padilla goes, if he profited from the plane's disappearance and really did want to disappear and start a new life, it would have been a lot easier for him to do so in Africa than North America. And since Mutantu's photograph has never been circulated, and we really don't have any idea what he looks like, it would have been twice as easier for him to disappear if he wanted to. I think the key to figuring out what might have happened here is if the FBI ever decided to reveal why they closed the investigation in 2005. They may have done so for reasons of national security, which is why they cannot talk about it, but I'm sure it provides no comfort to Padilla's family that he is still missing, the authorities may no longer be actively looking for him, and they just will not explain why. Unless the FBI decides to provide answers someday, this might be destined to remain one of the most bizarre, unsolved aviation mysteries. However, if you happen to have any information about the disappearances of Ben Charles Padilla, John Michael Mutantu, and the missing Boeing 727 jet, please contact the appropriate authorities. Remember, the plane's tail number was N844AA, and its serial number was 20985. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released a fun special episode in which I counted down my top 10 personal favorite acting performances which occurred in reenactments on Unsolved Mysteries. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Jolene C., Kari, Cheryl K., Jeremy B., Karen B., Jim L., Melissa M., Robert S., and Shelley W. Thank you all so much for your support. I mentioned in the intro that I was doing a crossover project with Aaron from Generation Y, who also released an episode about this particular case. Well, sometime within the next few days, you will see a bonus episode drop into our respective feeds, in which Aaron and I will be discussing a case I previously covered on The Trail Went Cold, the wrongful conviction of Juan Rivera for the murder of 11-year-old Holly Staker. Our collaboration is part of a project called Crime Conversations, in which podcasters who are scheduled to appear at CrimeCon UK this coming September have been teamed up together for a series of special episodes. As I mentioned many times, The Trail Went Cold and Generation Y are just two of the many shows scheduled to appear on Podcast Row at the very first CrimeCon UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London on the weekend of September the 25th and 26th. If you would like to purchase tickets to the event, we have a special promo code you can use to get a 10% discount. So to receive 10% off, visit crimecon.co.uk and enter the promo code COLE21. That's COLE21. So keep an eye out for the special episode with myself and Aaron, which will be released soon, and we both hope to get the chance to meet some of you in London in a few months. In addition, I also wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after-show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's GETVOKL.com. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week, and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold.